Kære lytter, jeg tænker nogle gange på de ting, som vi taler om herhjemme. Hvordan ser man på de ting i udlandet? Er der en forskel på et dansk perspektiv og et internationalt perspektiv? Det er der jo sikkert i mange henseender. Men når vi taler om virksomheder og om erhvervslivet, hvordan ser det så ud? Er der en forskel på de temaer, som danske virksomheder er optaget af, og som udenlandske virksomheder er optaget af? Og er der en forskel i, hvordan man ser på dem? Det er jeg nysgerrig på. Så jeg benyttede lejligheden, da jeg i den her uge havde besøg af en af de tunge internationale iagttagere af erhvervslivet her i Møntergade. Jean-François Manzoni er professor og også formand for Business-skolen IMD i Lausanne i Schweiz. Han har en doktorgrad fra Harvard, han er forfatter, og han er et kendt ansigt i det internationale erhvervsliv. Og også i dansk erhvervsliv, hvor rigtig mange danske ledere i tidens løb har været forbi IMD og også haft ham som underviser. IMD er en business-skole, som i hvert fald efter min mening er god til at kombinere teori og praksis. For eksempel så spillede Jean-François Manzoni en lille, men vigtig rolle i den turnaround, som Niels B. Christiansen og Kim Fausing lavede i Danfoss tilbage i 2009. Da Danfoss var i krise, og de skulle lave en ny strategi, så ringede Niels B. Christiansen efter sin gamle lærer, Jean-François Manzoni, og bad ham komme og holde et oplæg for ledelsen i Danfoss. Og Jean-François Manzoni holdt et oplæg, hvor han talte om ledelse i en krise, og hvor han blandt andet talte om det, som han kalder alignment. Altså det her med, hvor vigtigt det er, at man i en ledelse er fuldstændig alignet. At man er fuldstændig afklaret og enig om, hvad man vil, og hvad det er for et budskab, som man kommunikerer til sin organisation. Så han kender dansk erhvervsliv. Da han for eksempel var her i Møntergade, så havde han lige været ude hos Novo Nordisk i Bagsvær. Forud for min samtale med Jean-François Manzoni, så bad jeg ham udvælge de vigtigste temaer. Når han taler med topcheferne i de globale virksomheder netop nu, hvad er det så for temaer, som de er optaget af? Rigtig mange viser det sig, og han taler meget, så vi må begrænse os. Så her taler vi om to temaer. Vi taler først om geopolitik, og om de dilemmaer, som geopolitik sætter topcheferne i, og med Kina som et eksempel. Vi taler også om det, som han kalder for future readiness, og som især handler om, at generation Z, og om udfordringen med at tiltrække og fastholde talent. Og til sidst, så spørger jeg ham om, hvordan humøret egentlig er i den her tid hos de internationale topchefer. Og til sidst samler jeg op. Velkommen til Topchefernes Strategi. Jean-François Manzoni, welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
If we start by geopolitics, we are living in very unpredictable times, and many CEOs are working hard on the challenge to protect themselves from the black swan event. We talked in the telephone earlier to this interview, and you told me that the challenge with geopolitics is that leaders cannot influence uncertainty, but rather have to adapt to it. Proactive adaptation involves trying to forecast outcomes. That challenge to forecast outcomes seems very difficult for many companies, also big companies.
So, first of all, I think it's not only black swans. The term black swan has become very overused. Black swan really was meant for events that are totally, absolutely, utterly unpredictable. In that sense, for example, COVID was not a black swan event. Bill Gates had been warning of a pandemic for years. So yes, there are black swans, which is, you know, things that are completely unpredictable.
The war in Ukraine?
No, the war in Ukraine is not a black swan, because again, Putin had been, you know, gradually grabbing territory, and he had been warning about this for years. So you need to distinguish black swans, which is, oh wow, you know, we had no idea that this would come up. And where the solution is more to create a resilient organization, or as the author of the Black Swan book called it, anti-fragile. And then this current situation, which is that it is very difficult to predict how some of the geopolitical tensions will evolve. Now, I am not sure that really what CEOs are trying to do is to forecast outcomes, because you're always going to have to forecast a range of outcomes. You see, it's not like you're going to be able to say, this is the way it's going to turn out. I think that what's happening in boardrooms and in top management team rooms these days is you're trying to look at several possible outcomes. And, you know, one possibility is will turn out this way, another possibility is will turn out that way. And, you know, maybe you can start imagining, maybe saying, you know, this is like maybe 25% probability. But what you try to do is to envisage multiple outcomes, and you ask yourself, well, if the world turns out this way, you know, what do I need to do? And then you start realizing that maybe for three of the four possible outcomes, there's the same response, right? And so I think that's rather the kind of discussions that's happening. You're looking at various scenarios, and you're asking yourself, how would I react? How would I be best positioned in that if that scenario unfolds?
But looking at scenarios, that's not a new discipline to a CEO.
No, it's not. What is, I think, no, you're absolutely right. It's not. This practice started at Shell decades ago, and a number of organizations are very good at helping management teams think about this. In fact, on occasion, even we at IMD do that kind of thing. What I think is new is the severity of some of these scenarios. The world has never been an easy place. But I think that if we look over the last, 3-4 decades, geopolitics had become less of an extremely present and salient topic. You know, of course, there were protests here and there against globalization, but by and large, the world was moving on. And you know, China was happy to become part of a globalized world. Over the last few years, the tensions have reappeared. Of course, over the last 2 years, Russia's attitude has become quite belligerent again. And now suddenly you're looking at events that potentially can degenerate. Again, what's happening in the Middle East right now could degenerate in a dramatic sort of fashion. So I think for a number of decades, we didn't really have too many of these. Over the last few years, we've been reminded that on occasion, the world can become an extremely dangerous place.
But if you want to adapt to geopolitics, you also, I guess, you need to understand geopolitics. And it seems to me that many CEOs find that very difficult, since, in my opinion, they are educated and used to think logical and rational to create value. But geopolitics is also about, you know, national identity, feelings, non-rational thinking, intuition.
So I think you'd be surprised. Some CEOs are actually quite sophisticated in their understanding of the world. Now, which is not to say that every CEO is, but some CEOs are actually quite sophisticated. Also, remember, CEOs are not doing everything by themselves, right? So, for example, one of the large multinational with whom we've done work over the years had a chairman who had been CEO before of this organization, became chairman, and the first few years of the new CEO on the job, the chairman was staking a fair amount of the figurehead role and the geopolitical connection role. So you know, you have CEOs, you have top teams. On the top team, you could have one or two individuals who are quite sophisticated in this area. Then you have a board. On the board, you could also have individuals who have specific knowledge of specific regions. Again, I happen to be a director on the board of a listed company in Singapore, and we have among us one colleague who is extremely knowledgeable about China. And he is on the board because he is extremely knowledgeable and well-connected in China. So you're right. It's one additional challenge for CEOs. But I think, A, some of them are very sophisticated, have become sophisticated because they read a lot, they talk a lot, they travel a lot. And also they can surround themselves with people who can help them.
So in general, the present generation of CEOs, actually, they have the capabilities to understand geopolitics. Which capabilities are the most important to understand geopolitics?
So I think one, of course, is reading and studying. Because, as you said, the world is a complex place, and there are some regions where, you know, the challenges are not just appearing now. You know, I had a house in Corsica for a while, and, you know, some Corsican stories go back 400 years. So in some of these places, you've got animosity that's going back decades and so on. So one is you have to read and study and talk to people. So learn. Two, I think an ability to relate to perspectives that are not yours. I think that's one of the things that we really try to teach leaders at IMD. If you want to be able to bridge gaps and to work across fault lines and across boundaries, you need to have the ability to relate to points of views that are different from yours. The fact that I can relate to your point of view doesn't mean that I have to agree, and it doesn't mean that I have to think the same way you do, but I have to be able to relate. What is dangerous is individuals who live in a world and they have limitations, and in some cases, lack of capacity altogether to relate to people who live in other perspectives. I think smart leaders need to be able to relate to perspectives that are different from their own.
So two capabilities are very important, the ability to learn and the ability to relate.
Yes, I guess if you want more, another one, I guess, is to surround yourself with people who are potentially more knowledgeable than you are, and to have the humility and the confidence to inquire from these individuals. There's a wonderful quote that says the problem is not what people don't know. It's what they think they know, but it ain't so. I often say to CEOs, you start becoming dangerous when you're sure about something. As long as you're not so sure and you're willing to ask others and to think about it, you're not that dangerous. So I think the third one would be, in addition to the first two, the third one would be surround yourself, have the confidence and the humility. It's both qualities to get other perspectives and get more information.
Okay, let's take an example on geopolitics, namely China. We in the West, we have tried to integrate China into US-led institutions in the hope that when China got more wealthier, they would become like us. But now we learned that they are still Chinese. So I think increasingly it's becoming relatively clear that we are not going to have a rapprochement anytime soon. So in terms of geopolitics, how is the CEO's view on China anno 2024?
So, as it happens, yesterday I had lunch with the president of a university who was coming from Hong Kong, and we had lunch in Lausanne. And one of the reasons why he wanted to discuss with us a possible partnership is exactly the one that I mentioned before, which is that he is under the impression, and I think under the correct impression, that we're not going to tell him how to lead his life. And we're not going to tell them every 5 minutes why their way of life and their governance model is all screwed up. Please forgive my French. And, you know, they should use ours instead. I think that again, a smart CEO today looks at China and says China functions in different ways than the rest of us. And by the way, probably rightly so. You know, if you said, let's make China a US-type democracy tomorrow morning, trust me, you may not like the outcome. Look at what's been happening in some parts of the world where we, quote-unquote, brought them democracy. It's not easy. So China functions on a different model. Smart CEOs understand the governance in China, understand the role of the central authorities, also understand that China is also, in some areas, quite a decentralized sort of continent, that there is competition between geographies. But smart CEOs also define boundaries, because clearly over the years, you know, sometimes it's been challenging in terms of what's appropriate and what's not. And then you have to decide what you're going to do with China in terms of China as a part of your supply chain. Clearly, what's been happening over the last few years is more and more organizations have diversified their supply chain outside of China. By the way, including Chinese manufacturers. So you see a development of Southeast Asia, including in Vietnam, for example, where people are saying, look, in case problems occur in China, we need to have other supply bases. So clearly, there's a lot of reflection around supply chains. COVID helped us understand that efficiency is not the only parameter. You also need resilience and flexibility. Then you have an issue of China as a market. Sorry, let me also add, in terms of China as a supplier, an interesting question is, what's your view on IP? So here you have very, very different view. One of the pharma companies I know says nothing useful in China because don't trust IP. Another international pharma company that we know says we don't think that this is a big issue. Of course, we're protecting our IP, but we're still doing quite a bit in China. So here, one of the key decisions that you're going to have to make is how much risks you're willing to take on the IP side, and how do you see that risk? Now then, as I said, that China as a market. The Chinese don't always play like super, super fair. Increasingly challenging for Western firms to make money in China. And then, of course, there's China as an investment destination. I think increasingly the decisions that companies are making is, do we have China for the world, China for Asia, or China for China?
And what does that mean?
So China for China means we're going to do stuff in China. We're probably going to do that stuff with Chinese investment money. And we're not really hoping to export much of anything. We're basically developing a strategy where we're going to invest in China, and the returns will be generated in China. China for Asia means that we're investing in China, but we're hoping that it will have an impact on our Asian strategy, including, for example, for the supply side. And of course, China for the world means that we're going to use China as an investment destination with capital coming from all over the world, and or as a supply base to supply the whole world.
So you need to have a very diversified or specific strategy for your business in China. Is that different from just a few years ago?
Yes, and no. So the question is not very different from a few years ago. You're right. I mean, a few years ago, you had to ask yourself the same question. But I think a few years ago, we were more confident that the Chinese economy was continue to develop, and Chinese society was continue to develop in ways that were maybe a little bit more predictable, and also a little bit more friendly toward the rest of the world. What I think we have found with President Xi is that you know, when he says, let's make China great, he means let's make China great, just like, you know, Donald Trump means making America great again. And so for a few years, in fact, a few decades, China was indeed very integrated in the world of nations, very integrated in commerce. Over the last few years, in part through their actions, in part through the actions of some American leaders, the tensions have become much more real, which means that in some cases, you can't sell. In some industries, you can't sell what you do to China. And in other industries, you're going to be taxed if you buy what they do. So this is very different from a few years ago.
This is, of course, very different when it comes to manufacturing and commercial issues. When I speak to Danish CEOs, maybe the most tricky question is the ethical issues. Because I can see that when Western and Danish companies are doing business in China, they keep quiet about human rights violations in China. They are very silent about this for obvious reasons. But is it possible for a company to have two sets of ethical values, one set for your business in China and one set for your business outside China?
So to your specific question, I think the answer is probably not. But let's be also maybe a little bit more precise about what we mean by ethical values and human rights violations. I think that increasingly Western organizations are being quite sensitized to where is this product made, by whom, under what conditions. And clearly, some supply chains have had to be adjusted to avoid production in specific areas where we either know or we strongly suspect that there are human rights violations. And there you cannot have two sets of ethical standards. You cannot say, well, you know, here we're really well behaved, there, you know, voilà. But that's one thing. And I think that this is happening. Organizations are asking themselves, you know, where is this product coming from, and do we have an issue there? Then you have the broader question of, I deal with China, I buy from, sell to, invest in China, and I happen to know that in some parts of China there is stuff that, if it happened in our country, we wouldn't really condone. Do I have to speak up about this? Now, this is again one of the topics that we discuss often with CEOs, is how do CEOs find their voice? Look, the reality is not every CEO should speak up about every topic everywhere. You know, first of all, they're not experts at everything. And number two, frankly, what, you know, this CEO thinks about what's happening in indeed some parts of China is, it's irrelevant to their business. They're not buying from there. And if you start commenting on every topic, I mean, that's, you're going to spend your entire day. I mean, unfortunately, the world is a place where there are so many reasons to express indignation.
But
so,
maybe, you know, your own employees will expect you to have sure. a point of view.
So we, again, this is one of the topics we discuss, indeed. And again, the question is, on which topic do you as a CEO choose to speak up? And on which topic do you choose not to speak up? If I take my own very humble situation, I have that question. I have alumni all over the world. And trust me, they want me to have a point of view on every topic. And there are many topics on which I haven't said anything. And then there are some topics on which we have expressed a point of view. And when people want me to comment on something where, after discussions with my colleagues and or with my board, we decide that we don't have a particular expertise, nor is there a particular legitimacy for us to speak up, I generally respond directly to this alum and say, look, you have the right to think what you want about this topic. I have the right to think what I want as a private citizen about this topic, but I don't have a right as the president of IMD to start sharing my points of view on what's happening in Tibet or what's happening to the Uyghurs or by the way, what's happening in the south of the United States and so on.
On the other,
so we have to choose our battles is my point.
Huh? On the other hand, when it comes to China, I anticipate that it's not only about being skeptical towards or fearful about what's happening in China. We could learn from them and from their competitive advantages. I can see, you know, when I see Temu or I see Shine, I see they are very good at using artificial intelligence to understand customer behavior. They are extremely good at connecting customer insight very fast to changes in the supply chain.
Absolutely.
So do you see this trend that we are also beginning to learn from them?
Absolutely. In fact, I can even tell you that last year, one of my colleagues, Mark Grieven, co-authored an article that was published in Harvard Business Review, and the title was something like, What the World Needs to Learn from Chinese Multinationals. We are present in China, in part, to work with Chinese multinationals and hopefully contribute to their development. We're also in China to learn from what's happening in China. Some of my colleagues wrote a book a few years ago on retail in China. Any individual involved in retail will tell you that retail in China is far more advanced than retail in any other part of the world. So you're quite right. China today is much more than a low-level factory that it was 20, 30 years ago. Today it is a vibrant environment at the forefront of technology in many important sectors, including solar panels, including, and here I'm thinking of my friend Henrik Andersen, who's the CEO of Vestas, including in wind turbines and so on. So including, and I'm sure you've seen this, in electric cars.
You called it future readiness. How do I make this organization future ready, including in terms of talent? Why is this topic so important?
Because I guess one aspect is COVID has accelerated the realization that a growing proportion of the younger workforce simply doesn't want to show up every day. Again, I have four sons. My oldest son is now 33 years old. The longest employment he has ever held is 6 months. And other than that, he has always been a freelancer and now is an entrepreneur and a CEO of his own firm. And there's a large segment among, you know, what is often called Gen Z that basically says, you know, we have a different relationship to employment and to employers. We want more flexibility, we want more empowerment, and we want more meaning. And so you have an obligation as an organization to be attractive to a proportion of the manpower, which is going to grow over the next few years as, you know, the final baby boomers retire and so on. And the other thing is, we also live in a world where you have to change internal structures and internal systems so quickly, you know, that you need your workforce to be agile. And that's what we mean by future ready. Future ready for us means the ability to perform and transform at the same time. And it sounds very simple to say, well, of course, every organization should perform and transform at the same time. But there are many reasons why it is not easy for organizations to do so. And some of these reasons have to do with habits and with capabilities that a future-ready organization will want to improve in their employees.
We hear a lot about Generation Z and their expectations from their employers. You just mentioned them. And sometimes I wonder, what are the strengths of Generation Z?
Well, I guess that would be an even better question if we had a choice. So if we could say, I'm going to trade this generation for another, look, I often say, first of all, we can't really complain about Gen Z, because who is Gen Z? They are kids. I mean, certainly they're my kids are. And so I think when we then complain, we should first look at ourselves and say, well, we raised them this way.
But I don't complain. I'm just curious. Do they have some unique capabilities compared to the older generations?
Well, certainly, they're more tech-friendly than most of us are. Huh? So that's very clear. I think also, frankly, and that's what I often say to executives, they want things that previous generations wanted as well. So I'm going to give you a choice. Huh? You can work for an organization where you have flexibility, where, you know, you are respected as a human being and as a professional, where we're going to help you develop over the years, where you feel empowered and where the organization has meaning because it has a purpose that is that has a positive impact on society. Now, you and I are probably at the tail end of the baby boom. Is that a bad thing? I mean, do you think that our generation would have said, oh no, my God, I want to be non-empowered, non-flexible? Of course not. It's just that the youngsters are demanding it. So I think that the youngsters are forcing us to create organizations that in many ways are more inclusive and are more flexible, and I think have the potential to be more productive than before. You know, why do you have to show up at 8:30 every morning, and why do you have to stay until 7 o'clock and basically face the traffic at the same time as everybody else in and out? I mean, the youngsters are looking and saying, why? And frankly, they have a point. So I think our encouragement is to say, look, as a general rule, when the sun rises in the east, you don't complain about it in the morning, right? Well, same thing here. You've got a generation, and by the way, they're not all the same. But yes, by and large, there are some trends that we observe. They demand more flexibility. They don't trust organizations to care for them over the long run. So they tend to have a slightly shorter time horizon in terms of, you know, my patience with the organization. They want more empowerment. They want more meaning. Well, what we're doing is we're helping organizations to create structure, systems, and an environment where people are going to be excited to join and excited to contribute. Because when we say that they're lazy, that's actually not true. Some of these kids, once they have found what they're passionate about, they can work incredibly hard. It's just that they need to feel more attraction than, I guess, previous generations. You know, we showed up because we were told to show up. They show up if they have something important to do.
So when a CEO wants to attract and retain these, you call them youngsters, is it difficult to attract and retain them since you know what to do?
So what we observe is some organizations investing a lot of time and energy in developing their employer value proposition for Gen Zs. And it's really a question of what do we have to offer? What are the values and the benefits that you're going to get if you work with us? And of course, in return, here is what we ask. I think this is also very important. Too long and too often, organizations have said, I want to recruit the best. There's no such thing as the best in an abstract term. This morning, we had a discussion with the CEO of a very well-known organization in Denmark and throughout the world. And he's quite clear that there are some things that are non-negotiable and that they demand from people and that they screen people for. So he's quite clear about, if you join us, you know, here is what you'll find. And, you know, it's an exciting environment. We'll care for you. We'll develop you. By the way, you'll also be accountable for your actions. But, you know, it's a very productive and supportive environment. And then there are some things that we will ask of you. And what you find is you find some organizations have been thinking about it for longer. And some organizations, again, do not complain so much about the characteristics of Gen Zs. They're saying, look, if they want more of this, more inclusiveness and more flexibility, for example, how can we offer more inclusiveness and more flexibility and obtain significant performance in return? So I think smart organizations work hard at this.
It seems to me that maybe Generation C has very different values among each other. Does this create a risk for polarization internally in an organization?
Ah.
They have very strong opinions.
Yes. Now that is a very interesting point, a slightly different one, but a very interesting point. What we observe indeed across the world, what researchers observe, is that social media have a tendency to polarize opinions. And so where you would, you know, historically think of opinions as being distributed around some form of normal curve, increasingly you find that there's like bimodal distributions with people with strong opinions. I think it is worse in some parts of the world than in others. For example, I think that in some parts of the United States, this is a real challenge. at work and in people's private lives. So I think indeed you're quite right that this is, I don't think that this is a business-driven effect, but this is a societal reality that increasingly, with the reduction all over the world, again, starting from the US, in the belief that there is such a thing as truth and there are such a thing as facts. Well, if there's no truth and there are no facts, well, then we can have different opinions and your opinion is as good as mine. And then with social media, you observe this polarization. This is indeed going to be a challenge for society.
I can see, for example, in Europe, we have very strong opinions on what's going on right now in Gaza. And if you get those opinions inside your organization, that can be a challenge.
Yes. So on this front, again, our position at IMD is to say smart leaders are bridge builders. To build bridges, you need to be able to relate. You need to be able to decenter. You need to be able to look at the world from another angle than the one that you're accustomed to. And we also say, but you need to have also a sense of boundaries and a sense of clarity about what your values are. So indeed, as the president of IMD and as, you know, my colleagues, faculty members at IMD and staff of IMD, we don't control societal trends. We don't control the development of social media and the polarization of opinions that it creates. But we can help leaders to continue to be effective and, by the way, continue to manage themselves in that world where, indeed, opinions are polarized. The notion of truth can become quite confusing for some individuals. And indeed, this is requiring more skill and more self-management for leaders.
My last question. When you speak to high-level CEOs, how are their mood right now? Are they optimistic, pessimistic, confused, seeking?
I think it depends whether it's the official or unofficial response.
The unofficial. So,
the official response, very briefly, I finish every one of my CEO dialogues, and I've done 35 over the last 3 years. I always finish with, and you love your job because... And I always get a great answer. There's only one out of 35 who said, I'm not sure I love my job. And I thought, and man, has it showed over the last hour. But most CEOs indeed have gotten used to their job, and they have designed their attitude toward their job in a way that helps them to have energy. Privately, I think most CEOs would say, man, it's a hard time. You know, the requirements for CEOs are intense. You've got to be a great strategist. You've got to be a great communicator. You've got to be able to build bridges. You've got to be able to travel the world and have your body and your mind in different time zone, and it's not supposed to show. By the way, you're also supposed to have a family life. And by the way, if you could have a sense of humor, it would be good. And if you could be super patient, while at the same time being quite decisive, that would also be nice. So the requirements of the job, together with the instantaneity, together with the, you know, it's hard to disconnect, is increasingly demanding. What you find is smart CEOs find ways of creating boundaries. Again, that's one of the questions I ask them. How do you keep yourself at peak performance? I think that, again, smart CEOs try to focus on what they can control so they don't spend too much time complaining about things that are outside of their control. They look at what they can do to help their organization and their various stakeholders to move to a more prosperous, sustainable, and inclusive world. I really think that that's what most CEOs are trying to do today. Again, I understand that in the public's eye, maybe there's an all rotten sort of thing. I promise you that when I meet CEOs, the overwhelming majority of them are smart, hardworking, and well-meaning people. And then, of course, as I said, it's a hard job and they're doing their best.
But I guess to be a leader or a CEO, it has always been a hard job.
Yeah, but it's become much harder. And again, it's become much harder because, you know, not so long ago, if you were a CEO and at some point, you know, you lost your temper or you lost patience and you know, you kind of cursed at somebody or you were a little bit curt with somebody, you know, people would say, yeah, sure, you know, you deserved it, you know. Today, there's a phone everywhere, there's websites everywhere, and the requirements in terms of self-control are immense. Also, a few years ago, CEOs didn't have to have a position on what's happening in Gaza, what's happening in Ukraine. By the way, what do you think about mental health? By the way, what do you think about transgender? What do you think about this and that? You know, the number of things on which CEOs are supposed to be able to comment has exploded. The speed at which the right answers evolve or correct answers evolve is also increased dramatically. It's a much tougher world for CEOs. Probably also for everyone, huh? But it's a much tougher world than it used to be.
But hasn't there been a tendency to say that the present time we are living in, it's especially difficult, much more difficult than it was 10 years or 20 years ago?
So you are quite right that there has been a tendency to say the world is going down the tubes. That is very true. It was better before. That is true. In fact, I have books with quotes that go back all the way to the Romans. So you're talking 2000 plus, where some Roman philosophers are saying, oh, the world is going down the tubes, the younger generations don't listen to anything. True. And I think that's not what you heard me say. If you ask me to compare today's society from before, let's be very frank. There are less wars today and less long wars than there were at many times in history. The average life expectancy has increased dramatically. The quality of life. I mean, I remember my grandparents age 65, and I see some of my colleagues today age 65. You know, this isn't the same 65. So we can now cure or help you live with illnesses and conditions that heretofore were fatal. Also, let's be very frank, whether you think of gender diversity or sexual orientation diversity and openness, society is a lot more open today than it was 30, 40 years ago. So there's lots of things that have happened that I think are better in today's world than there were before. Access to information, access to education, much greater today. So again, you haven't heard me say it was better before. You haven't heard me say, God, I wish I could go back to the 60s. I don't. But you've asked me about the life of CEOs. I've been working with CEOs now for, believe it or not, you know, about 30 years. I think it's a tougher world today, and it's a more demanding world today than it was 30 years ago. But in many ways, also more exciting, but tougher.
Jean-François Mantone, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Det var denne udgave af Topchefernes Strategi. Et forsøg på at blive klogere på, hvad der står øverst på dagsordenen hos de internationale topchefer. Når det handler om geopolitik, så understreger han alvoren, at udfordringen stadig er at forsøge at tænke i mulige scenarier, og at det ikke er nyt, men at det nye er, at geopolitik er rykket så højt op på dagsordenen, og også at der står virkelig meget på spil nu. At verden kan, som han siger, udvikle sig til at blive et meget farligt sted. Det handler om at have viljen til at lære, at have erkendelsen af, at man har brug for at søge ny viden og ny forståelse, og at relatere til perspektiver, som er anderledes end den måde, som man selv ser på verden på. At det er noget af det vigtigste, som de underviser i netop nu på IMD. Vi talte også om Kina som et eksempel på geopolitik. At dygtige topchefer forstår, at Kina simpelthen er anderledes end os. De er ikke som os, og de har ikke noget ønske om at blive som os, og det skal vi forstå.
Han talte om, at det er blevet sværere at lave forretning i Kina, og om nødvendigheden af at have forskellige perspektiver på Kina. Det, som han kalder China for the world, China for Asia og China for China. Vi talte også om future readiness, om at tiltrække og fastholde talent. Om behovet for at tilbyde purpose og empowerment og fleksibilitet. Om at det handler ikke om, at den ældre generation, den som han og jeg tilhører, ikke også gerne ville have fleksibilitet og empowerment og mening. Nej, det handler om, at den nye generation kræver det. De forlanger det simpelthen. Og derfor er et moderne erhvervsliv nødt til at tilbyde de ting. Men når det er sagt, så har den nye generation også et potentiale til at blive mere produktiv end nogensinde før. Og når det handler om at tiltrække dem, så er det vigtigt at gøre op med sig selv som virksomhed. Hvad er det, at vi vil tilbyde dem? Det er ikke nok, at en virksomhed bare siger, at den vil rekruttere de bedste. Jean-François Manzoni fortæller, at en stor og kendt dansk virksomhed, og vi kan jo gætte på, at det er Novo Nordisk, som han taler om, at de er afklaret med, at de har nogle værdier, som de ikke går på kompromis med, og at de med det afsæt forsøger at finde et krydsfelt mellem at tilbyde for eksempel inklusion og fleksibilitet, og at få en stærk performance til gengæld. Og så anerkendte Jean-François Manzoni, sådan hørte jeg ham i hvert fald, at mange i den unge generation har meget stærke holdninger. Tag for eksempel konflikten i Mellemøsten, og at det er en særlig ledelsesmæssig udfordring, når man skal undgå, at det skaber en polarisering internt i en organisation. Og til sidst så fortalte Jean-François Manzoni om, at rollen som topchef er mere kompleks, end den har været før. Og jeg udfordrede ham på, om det ikke altid har været sådan, at det har været svært at være leder, og man skal passe på med at tro, at den tid, som vi lever i lige nu, at den er mere krævende at være leder i, end den tid, som tidligere ledere var leder i. Og interessant, synes jeg, som jeg nævnte i indledningen, at når jeg hører Jean-François Manzoni tale om geopolitik og om at tiltrække den unge generation, og også når han taler om topchefernes humør, så kan jeg genkende hans synspunkter fra de tilsvarende diskussioner her i Danmark. At de iagttagelser, som han har fra sine møder med internationale topchefer, de matcher de iagttagelser og de overvejelser, som vi kender hos danske topchefer og i danske virksomheder. Det var denne udgave af Topchefernes Strategi. Tak til Jean-François Manzoni, formand for IMD. Tak til Peter Emil Witt, der redigerede optagelsen, og tak til dig, der lyttede med.